I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Are you feeling news fatigue? Are you overwhelmed by the onslaught of information, misinformation, and disinformation in your feed and confused about how to tell the difference? A daily diet of bad and upsetting news can make you feel helpless and afraid, preferring something more benign and lighthearted to distract from all the stress. Our guest, psychiatrist Richard A. Friedman, wrote recently in The Atlantic that an information blackout might temporarily spare you such discomfort, but denial can be its own source of anxiety. That's a quote. He's a professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the Psychopharmacology Clinic at Weill Cornell Medicine, and he joins us today on The Connection to talk about how to manage our mental health in stressful and uncertain times. Now, polls are finding that more Americans are feeling anxious about their lives and worried about the political future of the country. Are those feelings connected? Well, Richard A. Friedman, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. How do you take the emotional temperature of the country?
Several ways. As a psychiatrist, I can see it in my patients, how upset and anxious they are. I just have to spend time with family and friends to see how anxious and upset they are. And if I spend time reading the news, I get to see just how anxious and upset I am.
It's interesting, and I mentioned this in my introduction, but I also noticed, just to add to our anxiety here, that the United States is lower on the happiness scale compared to a couple of years ago. Of course, the stock market is in free fall as we speak. Consumer confidence has taken a hit. Looking at all those economic measures, how do you factor those in?
Well, I think what you just mentioned was one piece of a larger, atmosphere of anxiety and uncertainty. There's been so much change since Donald Trump took office for the second time in the country that if you look around at anything in our society now compared to what it was 2 or 3 months ago, there's almost nothing that you can point to that is not being changed. And in a way that people have no idea about. I mean, if you just look at the tariffs that were announced today, within 24 hours, people went from feeling secure somewhat with their financial situation to seeing that the stock market has tumbled. And, experts, political and economic experts, look at this and are scratching their head to explain to people how to make sense of this, how to think about this. So, of course, it just makes people very, very anxious.
And the fact that we have so little control over so many things in our lives, including the stock market and the government, we control our tiny little corner of the universe, but not much else.
Right, right. And so it does make you feel helpless when you take a look around and you realize that these are very large forces that you don't control, because policy is set, let's say on the executive level. And we have a president who loves to hoard executive power. And, if you look out and see what's going on in the country, it's very easy to feel helpless. And the response to this is basically people become anxious and may even feel like giving up. After all, what's the point of doing anything if you can't change it?
But we can't give up, right?
Well, certainly we can't give up. And actually, there's very good evidence in the country, I believe, that people are not giving up. In fact, there's very strong feelings that are being expressed, both in protests and also political action. For example, take a look at what happened in Wisconsin yesterday. Despite the fact that Elon Musk had poured millions of dollars to sway a race or effectively buy a race, the voters were having none of it. And so they took action, they exerted themselves, and they brought about change. So people actually are not truly helpless, but they feel helpless.
Let me go back, 5 years to the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, when many people were working from home, Many people just felt very disconnected from each other. We had to protect each other from ourselves by wearing masks and keeping our distance. How much of our anxiety, our loneliness, even our partisanship today do you think is a hangover from the pandemic?
A very large amount, I think. You know, we are still bearing the scars of the COVID pandemic in many ways. From the most fundamental, you know, the country was threatened, you know, mortally threatened by an invisible enemy. And, you know, unlike, let's say, a war in which you've got a human enemy who attacks you, which generally tends to unify the population, this assault to the country, COVID, was an invisible, a microbe, a virus that, you know, fundamentally, people had disagreements about the nature of this epidemic and what to do about it. And then President Trump also, you know, did not unify the country, but just quite the opposite. So instead of pulling together, we were a divided nation dealing with a mortal threat. So that was traumatic. We were socially isolated. There was a lockdown, and there were huge disagreements about the nature of this virus, the best way to treat it, how long to be locked down, whether schools should be closed and how long. So tremendous disagreement and polarization. And I think we still bear the brunt of this collective trauma. And it was a collective trauma because it affected everybody.
I wonder, on the one hand, whether we've forgotten about the trauma of the pandemic, but whether we've really truly grieved all the losses. A million people died. Now, some were elderly anyway, so they would have died. But nonetheless, a million people died as a result of the pandemic. Have we grieved those losses?
I don't think so. I don't think that I don't think it's so easy to do this. I think we tried quickly to move on afterwards. And, you know, grief is a long process. Almost everybody, if you think about it, knows somebody who died of COVID. So even though it was a million Americans, which is a staggering mortality, if you think of it, you know, we have 380 something million people. I don't know anybody who didn't know a person or have a friend of a friend who was close to them who avoided mortality.
I'm thinking, too, of the sort of, I guess, the pros and cons of forgetting or amnesia, which is, on the one hand, we forget things because it can help us, you know, manage through a crisis, manage our fear. But on the other hand, if you forget it and dismiss it, you don't really get to experience it, or in this case, to grieve about it.
Well, not only that, if you forget it purposefully or, you know, just reflexively, what happens is you still have the feeling, you have the anger, you have the sadness, but what's missing is a connection to the source of it. So what happens is you're suffering, you feel bad, anxious, sad, angry, but you no longer understand why you feel bad. And I think that was the result of COVID and not properly mourning this. We didn't come together as a country to have, let's say, a commemorative day of mourning and recognition about what we had gone through. You know, a country that grieves together, you know, heals together. And so we didn't have this. We had quite the opposite. But those feelings are still very much alive.
Is it too late to mourn all those deaths?
No, it's never too late to do that. And in fact, I've written elsewhere with a colleague of mine, George Macari, about the need to have a commemorative national remembrance day every year where we think about this and just have a few moments of silence as a kind of ritual in which we can think about the losses that we've had and the loved ones that we've lost.
Why are rituals, though, so important? Why is that important?
Because it brings people together and it actually tells us we are one country. We are unified by a collective experience of loss. It makes people feel less lonely, more united. And, you know, as my grandmother used to say, joys that are shared are doubled and sorrows that are shared are cut in half.
I love that. Is that something she said for rituals, yes. Weddings and funerals, so to speak?
I think for everything. It was a guiding principle in her life.
I wonder, too, whether trauma and traumatic memory also creates the climate for conspiracy theories and disinformation, because it seems we're kind of awash in a lot of that, and whether that comes out of trauma.
It certainly doesn't help. I think part of what drives conspiracy thinking is, you know, a very complicated world where things are changing very quickly, and the need to have some explanation and a sense of order. And conspiracy theories are basically explanations about various things that are going on. Let's take COVID, for example.
Sure.
There was a conspiracy that it was man-made, or that it was the result of, you know, powerful people who wanted to profit from making vaccines. So there was an accusation that Bill Gates was behind this and would then profit by making the vaccine and, you know, become even more wealthy. And so, conspiracy theories have the benefit of giving the believer the sense of comfort and knowledge and understanding, when in fact they're false explanations, but they're simple. They make complicated things seem understandable and simple, even if they're wrong.
Is there a connection to the kind of scapegoating that can come from feeling anxious and afraid, looking for someone or something to blame?
Well, yes, I think, you know, it's much easier to blame, you know, a human actor than it is to blame a microbe.
Right.
You can't get angry at a microbe, but you could certainly get angry at a human actor. You can't get angry, for example, at economic changes that affect whether or not you have a job, but you certainly can get angry at a false scapegoat. You know, if you're told, for example, an immigrant is taking your job when in fact it isn't true, it's easy to understand that as an explanation than to be told something like, you know, the nature of our economy changed. We're no longer basically a manufacturing economy. We're a knowledge-based service economy, and your job's just evaporated because of huge economic forces. That's very abstract, and it's not satisfying. It's much more satisfying for people to have a scapegoat that's human.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with psychiatrist Richard A. Friedman. He specializes in mood disorders. He writes for The Atlantic. And we're talking about a whole bunch of things that are making us very anxious these days. We've been talking a bit about the pandemic, the kind of holdover from the pandemic. And we'll be talking more about the state of our politics and the state of our emotional lives. We've got much more coming up after this very short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and our guest today on the show is psychiatrist Richard A. Friedman, and we're talking about how to take care of your mental health in stressful and uncertain times. Let me ask you one more pandemic-related question, but do you think we have learned any lessons from the last pandemic? I mean, it should be said that people are still getting COVID, and some people are still dying of COVID, but there are new viruses that are appearing on a regular basis. There's the bird flu, measles outbreaks. Are we prepared for the next big pandemic?
I mean, I think there's a split in the country between those who actually believe in science and medicine and those who are suspicious of it. So I think the answer to your question is many people, of course, believe in it and were beneficiaries of treatment and vaccines. And I think others are still very suspicious of it. And the problem is we currently have political leaders who are playing on fears. And instead of emphasizing the need for effective treatment, we now have a head of HHS who's a conspiracy theorist, RFK Jr. So I am extremely worried about the health of the nation and what's going to happen if and when we meet the next epidemic. How will we handle this?
Why do you think our political system is so susceptible to, you know, anxiety, scapegoating, anger, and fear?
That's a complicated question, and I think that the answer largely has to do with it is probably one of the most powerful ways to engage voters. If you essentially emphasize narratives of anxiety and fear and get them to vote for you, you know, what motivates that may not actually be true belief on the part of politicians in such policies or crazy ideas so much as getting themselves elected to then enact policies that, you know, are not in the best interests of even the voters who have supported them. That is, it's quite cynical, but that's more a political discussion than it is a science or, sure, or psychology.
I wonder too, though, and I've heard this, it's not exactly a statistic, but at least a narrative, that politics has taken a much takes a bigger part of our identities. And in the olden days, maybe not so long ago, if someone married out of their race or religion, that was often was a crisis within the family. Now, if a Democrat marries a Republican or a Republican marries a Democrat, that can cause the same kind of turmoil, the same kind of angst within the family. Does that make sense to
you? Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are, you know, so polarized in a way which, you know, in my lifetime, I've never seen. You know, in the past,
really?
You might say, look, I mean, we disagree. You know, we'll have to, you know, civilly agree to disagree. But now, people who are outside of your political tribe, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, are seen not just as, you know, people you don't agree with, but evil or bad. And you have political leaders, you know, and I don't think it's equal on both sides, who, you know, participate in the vilification of people who are outside their belief system. So it's not just that, you know, reasonable people can disagree about the nature of problems we face and what to do about it, but in fact, these people who don't agree with us are bad and they have to be destroyed. I mean, that's a totally different phenomenon. So when you say, you know, a crisis, I would say, yes, a crisis of tribalism.
Of tribalism, of looking to find like-minded people and then turning on those who disagree?
Yes.
How much is, in terms of mobilizing people, we talk about, you know, empathy and coming together and finding common ground, but how much do you think fear and anger is sort of at the bottom line, the real motivator of people and their behavior?
Well, fear is a very powerful motivator. And, you know, people take their cues, and we're very easily influenced, humans, that is, by appeals to fear. You know, if you just think about it, who is it who's more likely to do something? A happy, satisfied person or an angry, anxious, aggrieved person? Anger is a very powerful motivator. So if you have political leadership that emphasizes anger and division, you keep people riled up and engaged.
I wonder, too, about how one makes sense of one's life and also the world when living in a sea of disinformation and lies. In fact, I Googled President Trump's first term. He told 30,573 false or misleading statements. That is a lot of misinformation and disinformation. And clearly, you know, it's the same kind of playbook that we're seeing second time around. How do we navigate when it's hard to know exactly what's true and what's not true?
Well, a large part of the problem is, right, you're steeped, we're flooded with information, you know, and people live their lives on social media, and we're also segregated. I mean, we're in little bubbles. So you know, people, and because of the way social media works, if you, you know, spend time, you know, on Facebook or Instagram or, you know, YouTube or X or, you know, any number of these places, the algorithms feed you information that is consistent with what they know is your belief system. So it confirms what you believe. You're not disconfirmed. You're not exposed to differing ideas. So we're all kind of isolated. You know, before social media had such dominance, you were exposed to people at work. You were not marinated in information 24/7. And you had, I think, greater exposure to people who were different than you. And that's one of the most powerful ways of bridging divide between people. Instead of being these abstract categories, you actually have a neighbor, you know, who is a friend who you discover along the way. Oh, well, this person is gay. And it doesn't matter because you have a relationship with him and you already like them. So there's nothing strange about it, as opposed to a category in which, you know, you're told this category of people are to be viewed suspiciously. So personal experience with, you know, people outside your group is one of the things that tends to break down barriers. But in this day of social media and where people spend their time, they don't get to commingle with people who are outside their bubble or their tribe.
You talk about sort of marinating and all this information, misinformation, disinformation. And there are times when I'm reading the news and I literally feel shocked. I mean, not physically, but emotionally shocked, and almost have to, you know, throw my device away or throw the paper away. But it feels that way. It feels shocking.
Yes, it is shocking. And it's understandable why you'd have that impulse, because you want to protect yourself from, you know, something that causes angst, distress, and anxiety. So, you know, immediately after the election, there were many people that just turned off the TV. You know, cable news viewership just plummeted, especially, you know, on the Democratic side. And people disengaged. People went on news holidays in order to, you know, regain a sense of equilibrium.
And of course, many people were thrilled.
Absolutely. Sure.
I quoted you in the introduction to the show about this information blackout, as you wrote, might temporarily spare you from feeling discomfort, but denial can be its own source of anxiety. And I was interested in that because I think everyone's trying to figure out how to sort of manage their news diet. But you're saying there are dangers of cutting yourself off from this world of information.
Right. And the reason for that is that if you don't know what's going on around you, which is what happens if you shut off all news and play ostrich, put your head in the sand, then your lack of knowledge about the environment will increase the uncertainty. And we know perfectly well that uncertainty makes us feel anxious. And the reason is we evolved in a way so that situations where it wasn't really clear what was going on would read to us as danger. You know, way back in the savannah, you know, when there was wind ruffling, you know, and you know, the tall grasses were moving, the question would be, you know, what is that? Is that a predator in the grass? Is it just the wind? You know, uncertain situations make us feel anxious, put us on guard, and keep us, you know, ready for fight or flight. So if you turn off information and disregard what's going on in the world, you'll temporarily feel a little bit better. But actually knowing what's going on, even if it feels bad, in the end will make you less anxious.
That's so interesting. The analogy you use in that Atlantic article is that if your house is on fire, you don't turn off the smoke detectors or the fire alarm. You know,
right.
you have to stay vigilant. But that takes a lot of energy.
It takes a lot of energy. In an ongoing way. But you know, just think of it this way. You know, even if you know what's going on, if it's good or it's bad, you'll be able to adjust and adapt. If you don't know what's going on, uncertainty is even worse than a bad outcome. So for example, in medical settings, when people are waiting for biopsy results, and they don't know, is this going to be benign? Is this a cancer? The period of waiting is actually more upsetting than when people get the result, whether the result is good or bad. Just think about that. A bad result, meaning you know that you have cancer, you can adjust to that because you make a plan, you figure out what your treatment should be, and then you go through with it and your life goes on, even if it's sad. But the period of waiting, being uncertain, is intrinsically aversive to humans.
Worse than a bad outcome. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's psychiatrist Richard A. Friedman, our guest today on The Connection. And again, we're talking about how to take care of your mental health in stressful and uncertain times. Well, let me be practical here. I mean, what do you suggest people do if they are feeling out of control and anxious and stressed out and maybe even depressed? We can't control the world. We can barely control our own lives. What do we do to feel better?
Right. A couple of things. So I think the first is really the tried and true things. First, the obvious. Reconnect with your social network. Things that are shared, troubles that are shared, feel less painful. Anxiety that you feel that's shared, you're going to feel much better when you talk to your family and your friends, your loved ones, and tell them how you're going to be. They're going to support you. They're going to make you feel better. You're not alone, right? So activate your social network. Be sure that you sleep. You can't stay up all night long doom scrolling and looking at the news because sleep deprivation will make you feel terrible and you won't be able to think clearly and even act in a way that, makes things better. Exercise can be helpful, etc. But then think about what it is that you can do to regain a sense of control. So yes, it's true, you don't control the world. You can't control these things. But in your local environment, you have quite a lot of control. You can get involved, let's say, at any level, doing things that make you feel useful and good. That could be politics. That could be volunteering. But having a sense of agency when you feel helpless is the remedy itself. It almost doesn't matter what it is that you do. You have to do something. You have to be engaged in the world. You can't sit still and fret. The wandering mind is not a happy one. So you need to take some form of action in which you engage in the world.
I think, too, when we're looking at the last couple of months, I mean, clearly there's chaos, which is unsettling to say the least, but there's also cruelty, which is deeply disturbing to feel as if people are being targeted or scapegoated or, thrown into almost like a gulag because of something that they wrote or because they have a strange looking tattoo. I mean, obviously we can't control that, but it's deeply disturbing to know that there are people suffering because of this.
Right. Right. And that, what you just described comes straight from Autocrat's Handbook. That is how autocracies operate. And that is currently the kind of government that we are facing. The aim of those experiences is to intimidate the population and make everybody feel afraid and helpless. And so that if you give up, essentially, you have given everything up even before you've tried, and you're really not helpless. If you can't figure out what to do, it's not because there's nothing to do. It's because you actually haven't found it yet. So yes, in the face of that, what you just described, watching people swept off the street, naturalized citizens for exercising their First Amendment rights, right? It's terrifying. It's upsetting. It's enraging, right? People... So you can protest, you can assert your humanity, you can you can lobby your local political representatives in mass and say, this offends our essential American values, right? And I don't think that this is a partisan issue. I think that there are many people who on both sides, Republicans and Democrats, who, when they look at something like this, feel, even Ann Coulter said,
That's right.
Who's, you know, a well-known, you know, conservative, said, you know, there is, I'm paraphrasing, you know, there's almost no one I'd like to deport. But isn't that a violation of a constitution, constitutional right for free speech? So I don't think that this is, you know, a Republican or a Democratic issue. This is a democratic issue. The very nature of the constitutional rights and the freedoms that Americans have as part of this, you know, great American experiment, that's what's at risk.
And I wonder, in the authoritarian playbook, such as it is, whether when you see things happening over and over again, it becomes, or the fear or the concern is that it becomes normalized. And then you begin to say, oh, well, you know, that's just the way things roll here in America.
Right, right. Well, that's the intended purpose, to wear people down, make them feel helpless, and make them capitulate. And we know this from, you know, studying, you know, autocratic regimes all over the world, that actually protesting and not giving up and pushing back is the proper response, and it's effective.
I Googled authoritarian psychological components or something, and I think AI gave me some things that I'm holding here. Factors contributing to the appeal of authoritarianism: fear and uncertainty, anger and frustration, need for security, loyalty and belonging, early experiences and socializations. Is that we do know, and we're almost about to break here, Richard, but we do know sort of what the features are for authoritarianism, but sometimes it feels as if it's just overwhelming.
It does feel overwhelming, but you cannot lose, you know, sight of the bigger picture, which is we're an old country with a tradition of democracy, and this is an assault. What you're describing, and you know people cannot give up. They may feel helpless, but when you start to feel helpless, that's when you know that you have to engage in the world and you have to do something that makes you feel like you have an effect. But the most important thing is not to give up and not to do it in a preemptive way.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll get back to our conversation after just 1 minute. And you're listening to the Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Richard A. Friedman is our guest. He's a psychiatrist. And we're talking about the state of the world, the state of America, our own emotional states as well. Do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. How are you feeling these days? Polls are finding that more and more Americans are anxious about their well-being and worried about the political future of the country. Our guest today on the show is Richard A. Friedman. He's a psychiatrist. In fact, he's professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the psychopharmacology clinic at Weill Cornell Medicine. And we've been talking about a whole host of issues here on the show. I heard Esther Perel recently, and she's a pretty well-known therapist, but she described our country and our divided political system like a couple, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats, I guess, as a couple who cannot stand each other, but they can't or they won't divorce each other. And I wonder whether that fits your definition of our country. Is that helpful?
It's an interesting metaphor. I don't know what a divorce would look like. I mean, after all, we all live, you know, in an interconnected society. Where would they go if they separated? Is it imaginable that you're talking about, since Democrats and Republicans live in the same state, you can't secede. We tried that once, called the Civil War. So I don't know that, I mean, certainly in terms of like human passion, I think that that's true. But I don't, in terms of what it is that we need to do in order to fix this, I'm not sure that it's the most useful metaphor.
But I wonder whether it gets to sort of the feelings that people have, which is that we're a family, we're a country, we're in a sense stuck with each other, but we're, you know, we can't seem to resolve a lot of problems, and we can't break apart either.
Yes. We're, you know, at war with one another, stuck in the same household, and we have to figure out how are we going to get along? And the first step, if you were, let's say, a family therapist looking at the two, you know, aggrieved parties, is to have them sit down and say, okay, what is it you really think about one another? And have each party explain, you know, the nature of their grievance. And then you would try to address the distortions. No, you know, you would say to the Republican, this person is not trying to take away your right for religious belief or force any of, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you would try to go through all the beliefs that people have about one another and, you know, address them and correct them. But there's no way nationally to do this. You know, that's the role of a moral leader, you know, to choose to, you know, be the president of everybody. You know, for example, a Republican who gets, you know, elected says, I realize that this was a contentious election. I want to reassure you, I'm everybody's president, right? The current occupant of the White House is the opposite. He basically is very partisan and made it very clear he's, you know, he's a one-sided, you know, his loyalty is very partisan. So, you know, that just increases polarization.
I wonder too, in picking up on you know, sort of how we learn to live together in this country, is it important then to understand how people came to believe what it is they believe? What is their story? You know, what is their narrative? How did you come to this place? Is that helpful to know about? Especially someone that you may look at and say, we have nothing in common.
I think it's very important. I mean, the ability to, you know, suspend our judgment for a second and just see our fellow Americans as human, and be curious about them. Like, how do you talk to somebody who's really different than you? Well, the first thing is you basically invite them in and say, like, you know, tell me, you know, a little about yourself. Tell me how you got to think the way that you do. Right. If they think very differently than you, that is, just show curiosity. And have them tell you about it and learn about it, and don't suspend your judgment. You know, how do you essentially, you try this exercise of empathy, you put yourself in their shoes, imagine their life, how they live, and why they feel the way they do. And you might come away with it thinking, for example, you know, talking to someone who supported Trump, you know, who was very angry about the economy, was angry about the high cost of living,
sure.
You know, the cost of consumer goods, et cetera, et cetera. Totally get this, right? You'd say, yeah, you know, I can easily understand why you would support somebody who's promising to make everything better. That makes sense, right? It seems rational. And if you're having this discussion with somebody, you might start off like that. And then somewhere along the way, you'd say, but I'm wondering, how exactly do you think he's going to do that? How will that happen? Is it enough to just say, I'm going to fix something? Or do you have to give an explanation? I think you need to explain it to people. So when you're having a discussion, it's interesting to suspend your judgment, get to learn how they're thinking, what their point of view is, and then drill down a little bit, still asking questions like, how does that work? How's it going to come about?
You mentioned the word empathy. Do you see empathy as a kind of antidote to our authoritarian impulses?
Very much so. I mean, if you have empathy for people, it's hard to treat them in an autocratic manner, because you can imagine how they would feel. I mean, empathy doesn't mean that you necessarily have to love everyone.
Right.
It simply means you have to understand how they think and feel. And I think that the consequence of that, obviously, is that you feel, you know, it humanizes people. If you don't think of them as a category, but they're individuals, and you know a little about them, it makes it hard to think of them as a category, you know, as a Jew, a gay person, a Southerner, whatever you want to say, whatever category you want to put them in. But no, this is Mary, this is Susan, this is Richard, this is Alan, and here's their story. So the more information, the more specific, the more human they are to you, the less likely you are going to see them as other.
Do you think being raised by an authoritarian parent kind of predisposes a person to want to believe an authoritarian leader?
I think there are many routes to, you know, having, you know, finding authoritarianism appealing. You know, yes, having, you know, parents who are, you know, very, very, very strict and authoritarian probably helps. But I don't think there's one route to this.
And I wanted to, and it's not just in America, but I think in many places around the world, there is this appeal for, you know, powerful leaders to tell us what to do.
Right. Well, I think that that is a natural impulse when people feel insecure. And, you know, when you look around at the situation in the world, there's so much change and such big forces that have combined to make people feel economically insecure, socially insecure, financially insecure. You know, there've been enormous, you know, movements of people from, you know, one country into another. So you've got, you know, huge problems with immigration and fears that that sparks. You have climate change, which drives this along with income inequality. I mean, so there's just so much that is going on. And I think that typically what happens is in times of, you know, extreme change and economic uncertainty, people are susceptible to demagogues who promise simple solutions and show strength and come along and say, I'm going to fix everything.
Right. And one can understand.
Right?
Understand that appeal.
Right. Because you want the restoration of order. And there's also an appeal to the past, you know, when things were better. You know, let's turn the clock back and go back to this fabled past when we were prosperous, everybody was happy, you know, and, you know, it's a fiction, it's a fantasy that can be done, that you're facing these really complex situations. The solution is not to go in a time machine. The solution is to grapple with the problems head on and try to solve them.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's our guest today on The Connection, psychiatrist Richard A. Friedman. And we've been talking about the mood of the country, how people are feeling these days. And I should add that he is a clinical psychiatrist and also writes for The Atlantic. Well, speaking of the past, I'm a baby boomer, so I, you know, well remember. I don't totally remember the 50s, but I certainly remember the 60s and the 70s, and sort of every now and then have to remind myself of what we have been through as a country: Vietnam, Nixon and Watergate, assassinations, segregation, you know, the violent response to the civil rights movements, that we have, you know, we've weathered a lot of crises. But I worry about the current crisis that we're in and whether we have the wherewithal to weather this current crisis.
Right. I share your concern. And I think that many, many millions of Americans are also worried about the same thing. But I wouldn't give up so quickly. I think that, you know, people have not given up. If you take a look around the country at protests, things that people write, things that people do, take a look at what happened in Wisconsin, for example, I think that people are you know, shocked first and were, you know, awed and destabilized by what happens, but, you know, they're regaining their equilibrium and trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to deal with this unprecedented threat to, you know, our structure, our democracy? So you're obviously dealing with a very optimistic person
yes,
today,
me.
but I am not by no means is all lost.
Right. I mean, I have to say I'm generally optimistic, but I'm, you know, I have moments of deep worry, I have to say. And
right.
You also have written about optimism, that it can, you know, that it can kind of get in the way of activism, too, because you can say, well, you know, things will work out and we can just sort of slide through this crisis and see how things are when we get to the other side.
Yes, that's so true. I mean, optimism is a great, you know, coping strategy for hard times. But you don't want to have blind optimism, meaning you still have to open your eyes and take in what is going on. So it's fine to be optimistic if at the same time it doesn't stop you from acting and bringing about the changes that will really make you feel better. The problem is inappropriate optimism, because it can disarm us. It can make us feel relaxed when we should be anxious. So, you know, when friends said to me, you know, what can I do to feel better? I said, right now, it may not be realistic to feel good because the situation is dire. It's very scary. That is an appropriate response. Listen to your anxiety, just like you would listen to a fire alarm in your house,
right,
and take appropriate action, right? You would not disable the alarm. You can't disable your emotions. They're telling you something and you need to pay attention to them, right? So, you know, what's better than just blind optimism is engagement in the world. And also, you know, something, you know, a technique that you know, is called mental contrasting, that was developed by a psychologist, Gabrielle Ettingen, and her colleagues, in which basically when you're faced with difficult situations, you know, in order to adapt to them, think about the obstacles that are going to get in your way. Let's say it's going to be engaging politically, or, you know, finding people who, you know, think like you do. It actually is helpful, because it helps people understand what the real obstacles are. And if they think about them and imagine them, they're more likely to overcome them than just simply waving them away and saying, oh, everything is going to be fine. Everything is good. Everything is fine. And then you do nothing.
Let me make sure people understand mental contrasting. So you visualize a goal, and then you think about the obstacles to that goal, and that helps you have a kind of a game plan moving forward?
It helps you deal with all the trouble along the way that you're going to have in reaching your goal. So let's say I have a big exam coming up, and I say, everything's going to be fine. Instead, if I said to myself, well, I have 5 chapters to read in 4 nights. How am I possibly going to do this? And you start to strategize and think, well, maybe 1 chapter a day. But what's going to get in the way of my doing 1 chapter a day? Well, I tend to get out of my seat every half an hour. Well, maybe I can sit for 45 minutes, this kind of thing. So you actually start to think, like, very practically, what is it that will happen when I set out on this, you know, path to getting this, trying to achieve the goal. So it's kind of like mentalizing, thinking what's involved in this. So it's very realistic, right?
Yeah.
It's a practical thing. Instead of just saying, it's fine. By the end of the week, I'll be done with everything. Well, maybe you will and maybe you won't, but just simply, you know, deciding, you know, putting your foot down and saying it may not be enough.
We have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye. Why did you become a psychiatrist?
You know, first of all, I think that humans are so fascinating. Behavior is so interesting. And I really love solving problems. And my field has plenty of them. And, you know, mental pain and suffering is something that we actually can understand and we can do something about. And I'm also an intensely social person. So I have a job in which, you know, I'm essentially rewarded for being curious about human nature.
Asking lots of questions.
Yes. Yes.
Well, we have to leave it there. Richard A. Friedman, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. I really appreciate talking to you about a whole host of things. So thanks so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a professor of clinical psychiatry and the director of the psychopharmacology clinic at Weill Cornell Medicine. And he also writes from time to time for The Atlantic. Debbie Builder produces The Connection with Paige Murray Bessler. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.